So the Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Johnson, Judge Schleter, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Welcome everyone to our second and final oral argument for today's panel, April 5, 2022, the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next matter on our oral argument calendar is State of Minnesota versus Coleman. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel, if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Even though we are seeing each other and we can see each other's name on this Zoom presentation of our oral arguments today, we're only making an audio recording of the presentation over the argument, so please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep it for our public files and everyone's aware of who's making which argument. So far we've had no technical issues, but if there's any glitchiness in either audio or video, please alert us and we can pause the proceedings so we can catch up to the technology or let the technology catch up to us. Counsel for appellant, with that, we are ready to hear from you. You have the floor.
Thank you. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Travis Smith. I am a special assistant Redwood County attorney, and I represent the appellant State of Minnesota in this pretrial appeal. This is a domestic assault case where the victim gave a statement to police roughly half an hour after the alleged assault took place. In that statement, which was recorded by an officer's squad camera, the victim told the officers that respondent had assaulted him and gave numerous details of the assault, which were corroborated by the 911 call from the victim's mother and the officer's own observations at the scene. During both his statement to the officers and his statements to his mother that prompted the 911 call, the victim expressed his concern for the respondent and his desire that she get help. Months later, respondent's trial attorney conducted a recorded phone interview of the victim. No one else was present during that interview. In that interview, the victim made inconsistent statements, internally inconsistent statements, but generally seemed to be saying that if he were called to testify at trial, he would say that he didn't remember what happened on the night of the incident. Then, after the statement—
Mr. Smith, before you go on, can I just clarify, as I understand from your briefing, that the state is not appealing or contesting the district court's Dexter decision. So the posture that we have is the state agrees that it cannot call the victim as in its case in chief. And so the issue is the only basis for the statement is the district court's evidentiary rulings. Am I correct about that?
So the state has not appealed the district court's Dexter order to the extent that it made one. And I would say that to the extent that the district court made a Dexter order, I don't think that's entirely clear. But what it did rule was that the state could not call the alleged victim for the sole in its case in chief for the sole purpose of impeaching him with his out of court statements.
So, and the reason I'm asking that is, and I see from the transcript, the prosecutor essentially said to the judge, well, absent excited utterance or some other method to enter the original statement you were referring to law enforcement, we have no case. And I'm asking you, assuming that to be true, the second issue that you raise is the necessity of the defense attorney. I'm assuming we would need not address that if we conclude that the judge did not abuse its discretion in concluding there was no other evidentiary exception to allow that statement to law enforcement in. Because then, according to what the transcript indicates, the state agrees it has no case. There's no scenario in which the defense attorney would be a witness in that scenario, and we just simply would not have to rule on that. Does that seem accurate as I understand your argument?
I would mostly agree, Your Honor, although I think there is some question whether I agree that the state really has no case if it can't call the victim and if these statements don't come in under the either excited utterances or residual exception. But I think that what's complicated here is that the Dexter issue that we have exists because of the actions of defense counsel in taking these statements. And I don't know that we can, to a certain extent, get to the heart of the problems in this case
Before you go on, Mr. Smith, that's why I asked the first question. I didn't read the brief that an issue of Dexter was before us. It's the follow-up natural progression from Dexter, which per the Dexter itself, unless you have some other exception that would allow a statement to come in. And so you'll have to clarify that for me. In other words, the district judge wasn't asked to, I assume was not asked. I didn't see any written provision, and I don't think I saw anything orally that somehow Dexter cannot apply because it starts with a defense attorney interview.
That's correct. That issue was not that particular question wasn't put to the district court. I agree with that. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So moving on then, as long as we've kind of cut to the meat of it here, the district court in analyzing the both the excited utterances question and the question of the residual exception failed to adequately analyze those under the relevant legal standards, and in particular in with regard to the question of whether the victim's statement to police constituted an excited utterance, the district court failed to actually consider whether there was a startling event or condition. It said it could consider the second and third factors in the test, the necessary implication being that it couldn't consider the first factor in the test, whether there was a startling event or condition. And respondents' contention that it simply assumed that there was one for the purposes of conducting the analysis, I don't think is borne out by the order. And I think the district court wrongly thought that it had to conclude that there was actually an assault, which would be the ultimate issue for trial, in order to conclude that there was some startling event or condition that occurred. And that simply isn't true. What we know here is that there was an event that was startling enough to the victim that he called his mother and told his mother about what happened, and specifically told his mother that he was concerned about the respondent, that he didn't want to get her in trouble because she was on probation, but he wanted her to get help. And the events that had transpired in the house, as the statements suggest, resulted, and the police investigation demonstrates, resulted in the respondent passed out with a cut on her foot that was bleeding heavily and glass scattered all over the residence. And clearly, this evidence, coupled with the victim's response to it and the other allegations about what took place in there, including allegations of throwing drinks around, demonstrate that a startling event or condition had occurred. And the district court's failure to wrestle with that question and consider that question tainted its entire analysis of the excited utterances test. Because if you view the startling event or condition in that light, and then you look at the victim's statements to police, it's clear that when the police arrived, unbeknownst to him, by the way, he didn't know they were coming because his mother called 911. He didn't. So the police arrived unbeknownst to him. And it's clear throughout the duration of his statement to police that he's under the aura of excitement of the event that took place. He's concerned. He continues to demonstrate his concern about the respondent, his desire that she get help. He repeatedly asks whether she's okay. He tells the officer he thinks she needs to go to detox, talks about her going to the hospital. Interestingly enough, isn't particularly concerned about himself, but is concerned about her. And this demonstrates that had the district court properly analyzed the question of whether there was a startling event or condition and separated that out from the ultimate question for trial of whether the respondent assaulted the victim, it would have seen the case in a different light. And as I said, that fundamental error and that fundamental failure to analyze the first question, the ultimately most important question in the analysis, caused it to go astray as it analyzed the subsequent prongs of the test. And if for nothing more, at the very least, this court needs to remand this case, vacate the district court's order, and remand this case to the district court to reconsider to apply the correct analysis, to consider in the first instance whether there was a startling event or condition, and actually rule on that, as opposed to
Mr. Smith. Can I ask you, what do we make in the order? The judge says, to the point you're making, in this case, the parties focus on the second and third factors noted above. The first factor is the primary issue for trial, whether some kind of violent confrontation between AR and defendant did occur. So number one, it looks like the parties weren't interested in factor number one. But then when you read through the balance of the order, it does seem, at least to me, that the respondent's point is well put, that there's no dispute that something occurred in the house that led to law enforcement being called, that led to the questions. And so what I'm not understanding is, even if we were to assume that nobody except now the state's interested in factor one, how that would change our review of the overall order, because the judge was pretty thorough in explaining factors two and three and why that led to its conclusion that it's not an excited utterance. And so what more would the judge have had to say, I guess, for factor one to have properly analyzed it, and then for us then to look at the other factors and how somehow conclude then the court didn't abuse its discretion versus what you're arguing now?
Well, I think that what the district court needed to do was find whether there was a startling event or condition. And I don't think it would, the court has to apply the correct legal standard. The standard set forth in the rule is clear, and the articulation of it in case law is clear.
But what the judge was talking about, an assault, and how the victim at times said nothing occurred, then explained he was assaulted. Isn't it pretty clear that the judge was referring to the assault, which everybody would agree was the startling event?
Well, I think the startling event is broader, and that was the point I was trying to make, is by the court focusing so narrowly on the question of whether an assault occurred, as being the question of whether there was a startling event, it went astray on factors two and three. So I think because it didn't properly analyze factor one and reach a conclusion about factor one, that tainted the analysis as to factors two and three, and that's why it abused its discretion. I also think that the district court, in considering the ruling that the victim said that nothing happened, it is clearly erroneous. It's not supported by the record. And respondent's contention that the passage in Munson's police report, which was received as an exhibit, that the victim denied any cause for disturbance inside the residence, is a statement that the district court could fairly interpret as the defendant saying nothing happened, is not supported by the record, particularly when you look at the context, the entire context and the totality of the circumstances here. The statements that are made by the victim during the course of his discussion with police are entirely consistent with the 911 call and the details provided by his mother. And he had no idea what his mother told police. And again, the only thing that is remotely inconsistent is his perhaps claim that everything was fine. That's what Officer Haupt characterizes his initial statement as. Everything was fine between him and Amanda. Maybe everything was fine between him and Amanda at the time. She was passed out on the couch bleeding.
Mr. Smith, how many statements do you believe are part of the excited utterance?
I believe that the bulk of the conversation with police are part of the excited utterance, and I, to support that, I point to the fact that the defendant's speech isn't pressured. He's not visibly or audibly excited. That's partially due to the fact that he was intoxicated.
In my experience in dealing with excited utterances, and I haven't had, there's not a lot of case law on it, but I've always had the sense of an excited utterance being something it's usually blurted out in excitement. And you have here a back and forth, a discussion that feels like it's, at least to me, seems like it's outside the nature of a traditional excited utterance that's immediately following. There's this issue of timeliness. It immediately follows. It's a sort of a statement that is sort of explosive. Oh my gosh. Anyway, can you, you don't deal with that much in your brief. Can you address that concern I have?
Well, I think the case law doesn't draw a firm line as to how long. The question really comes down to whether the declarant continues to be under the aura of excitement.
When you say how long, you mean time or how long the statement is?
Time.
Have you found excited utterance is a doctrine that exists in all across rules of evidence, federal law, all across it. Were you able to find any cases where the utterance is such a lengthy rendition as what your position is would be comprised of an excited utterance in this case?
I haven't found any cases specifically, on point on that. I would again direct the court back to the fact that the test is whether the statement is made under the aura of excitement, and that can continue for quite some time. And I think that the record here demonstrates that the victim continued to be under the aura of excitement.
Right, but I'm getting to the extensiveness of the utterance. It seems like it's more of a speech and a dialogue than an excited utterance. I'm just wanting to know whether you found anywhere in your research this kind of a dialogue constituting an excited utterance.
I haven't. And I partially because I suppose I didn't do a deep dive on that particular point in light of the rule and the case law saying that the test is what it is. I see my time has expired. I'd be happy to try and address that more on rebuttal if you're interested in that.
Sure. And I just want to make sure that no more panel questions before you rest. Looks like there are no other questions. So yes, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal and you can delve into this or any other issue you like during that time in response to Mr. Leibold's argument. Counsel for respondent.
All right, may it please the court. I'm Mark Nivel, representing the respondent. The state is trying to make something out of, the court saying that, that they're being broken glass here, and that somehow that startling event, or that had to be a startling event. So everything that followed had to be the result of that startling event, but that ignores the circumstances that the court considered. There were, initially statements that, we're fine, nothing happened. And when you start out by saying that, it's hard then later, 20 minutes later, to characterize what happened as the result of an exciting event, especially where AR had a blood alcohol level of 0.371. So, that's going to put a damper on any, really make it difficult to respond in an excited fashion.
So, your brief doesn't get into the issue that I raised with Mr. Smith, but have you given that any thought? I mean, when I contemplate an excited utterance in the context of evidence law, I don't recall in any cases I've considered before, either before or after I joined the court, a dialogue, a lengthy dialogue being characterized as an excited utterance in the the usual evidentiary sense of the term. What is your position on that? And do you have any research that either supports or contradicts my concern about the dialogue being of this sort constituting an excited utterance?
Well, I think Your Honor's characterization of it hits the nail on the head. This was an extended dialogue, and there's no indications of excitement when the officers initially confront AR, and then it just goes on for 20 minutes, and then at the end, there's questions that elicit statements indicative of an assault having occurred about 20-25 minutes down the road. So, you know, the fact that there was the court properly assumed that a startling event had occurred, that an assault had occurred, without having to make some kind of judicial ruling on it, which would have been improper and could have prejudiced his ability to try the case or any other judge hearing that. But in any event, yes, this is an extended dialogue. No indicia of excited response on the part of AR. He's making statements initially that there wasn't an assault, that everything was fine. This is not the scenario of an excited utterance. It's not even close.
Mr. Nyvall, I'm going to maybe follow up a question to Judge Ross in a hypothetical way. As I look at the judge's order, the fatality, as you will, of the totality seemed to focus on the inconsistency of the victim's statements combined with the alcohol impairment. And so, because the judge even said specifically 25 to 30 minutes was not fatal, and then went on from there. So my question to you is, hypothetically, do you believe there would be no abuse of discretion if his statement had been consistent throughout and he was not obviously impaired, even though he was talking in a fairly low monotone-ish sort of way? Would that still qualify as an excited utterance? Every other fact being the same, in other words.
And I'm sorry, and what being different, Your Honor?
The lack of alcohol impairment and the lack of, as the judge said, internal inconsistency, because the judge really focused on that his statement went back and forth, but also that he was quite impaired. Although the judge did make some reference, didn't seem too excited either. So I'm trying to follow up Judge Ross to see if you have an opinion on that, if that scenario would be different.
Yes, I think the judge could have, even if there hadn't been this extensive level of intoxication, I think that the court could certainly and would have certainly reached the same outcome. The state doesn't provide any indication of the criteria to have an excited utterance. That's just, and that's why they're arguing, you know, things that the court didn't even find that there was a startling event. They have to deal with that, which is nonsensical, because the court didn't have to find that there was an actual assault and pronounce him guilty of it in effect. So yes, it's a roundabout way to answer your question, Judge Sleater, but yes, I believe the court could and would have reached the same result under the scenario you've just described.
Can I just follow up? So your point being is, in answer to Judge Ross's question, there does need to be excitement, is the point that to add to the trustworthiness?
Well, yes, there has to be, he has to make the statement in the aura of the excited event, the exciting event. And that just didn't occur here. The court didn't focus real heavily on the length of time that elapsed. We've got 20 minutes, 25 minutes. When they arrived, he was not indicating acting in an excited fashion at all. He wasn't saying, I just got smacked or anything like that. He wasn't saying, she's after me. I need help. He wasn't excited at all when they first got there, intoxicated or not. Regardless of whether that was the result of intoxication or not. This is just not the scenario of an excited utterance. And to follow the state's argument, and have them say that it was is just going to really complicate make inconsistent and hard to understand this the Minnesota court's rulings on what is required for an excited utterance.
Mr. Nyvel, one of the initial question I asked Mr. Smith related to the second issue, the necessity of the defense counsel as an attorney, and I've interpreted Mr. Smith's answer to be, and he can clarify and rebuttal, that if we agree with the district court, we don't need to reach that issue because the state doesn't have a case to present, so there's no scenario in which the defense attorney could be a defense witness. Would that be your understanding as well of that issue?
I think, thankfully, yes, that would be the answer. Yes, that would be applicable.
Thank you.
I'll stand on my brief in terms of that issue. Whether counsel has to be disqualified or should have been disqualified. Hopefully, it doesn't have to be reached. But I think my brief fully explains why the court did not abuse its discretion in denying the motion to disqualify. If there are no other questions, I'll stand on my brief.
Thank you. There appear to be none. Counsel for appellant.
Thank you. Travis Smith for the appellant, state of Minnesota. Again, Judge Ross, I do want to go back to your question about this notion of an extended statement or dialogue.
Well, and in responding, I mean, there's sort of another component that I didn't mention, and you can include it in your answer, which is this, again, maybe it's just dating back to my law school years, the idea of spontaneity doesn't feel like it's consistent with, I know that's not an express element that we include, but if you look back at the old case law, including in Minnesota, as the rule developed, spontaneity was part of the excitedness component, but if you could go ahead and respond.
Yeah, I would direct the court's attention to State versus Hodevet, which I cited in my brief, and it's 623 Northwest 2nd 909. It's this court's decision from 2001, and there the alleged victim of an assault gave a statement a recorded statement three hours after the event had occurred to an officer at the hospital. It was a recorded statement, which I understand to have been of some duration. She was heavily medicated when she made the statement. And this court concluded that while 3 hours had passed between the assault and the statements, given the extent of injuries and the nature of the assault, it is reasonable to conclude that she was still under stress from the incident. So I think that, I know it's not quite the clear answer that says, it doesn't explicitly say that an extended dialogue with an officer can be an excited utterance, but I think when you have the fact that we're looking at a 3 hour delay coupled with the fact that we do have an officer taking a recorded statement from a victim and what I gather is a structured way as opposed to an on the scene statement. The test really goes back to not whether it's an extended dialogue, not whether this is just blurted out all of a sudden. Certainly that would make an easier case for whether something's an excited utterance. And I don't disagree with you, Judge Ross, and that's what we all think of when we think back to our days in evidence. But I think this court's decisions and the Minnesota Supreme Court have made clear that sort of textbook kind of character that we all have of excited utterances isn't the exclusive scope of the rule. And I think Hogetevet, that I hope that's the way, at least reasonably, that's pronounced, demonstrates that this kind of conversation like it is, can be an excited utterance as long as the declarant is operating under the aura of excitement. Now, to the point of
Mr. Smith, so looking at the middle of page 7 of the district court's order, I interpret this part of the order to essentially say that the evidence fails the third requirement because, to put it simply, AR was not excited. I mean, if he's not excited, he's not under the aura of the excitement of an event. I mean, is that a fair reading? And if so, I mean, how do you overcome the standard of review of on a evidentiary ruling?
I think that's mostly a fair reading of the district court's order. I quite frankly think that the district court was so focused on the overarching question of trustworthiness and inconsistency that its actual analysis of that question of excitement is somewhat tainted. But I think that that's certainly a reasonable interpretation of what the district court said. With regard to the standard of review and how to overcome that, I go back to the fundamental question here of the district court not properly applying the test as a whole. And I believe that did really taint its analysis here. And I also think that the district court's conclusion that he wasn't excited is based on an erroneous assumption about the effect of alcohol on somebody's ability to be excited. And respondent has essentially argued in his brief that a person who's under the influence of alcohol to the extent that the victim was can't possibly be under the aura of excitement, can't possibly be excited because they're not going to be capable of talking in a fast way. They're not going to display the emotions we typically associate with excitement. But I think when you look at the statement as a whole, when you look at the fact that the victim is constantly talking, is saying things that aren't even in response to questions, that the evidence taken as a whole demonstrates that the district court erred when it concluded that he was not under the aura of excitement. And that was based on fundamental errors of law. And I think an unsupported assumption based on alcohol. I see my time has expired. I would respectfully ask this court to reverse the district court's rulings.
I have one more question, if I may, Judge Ross.
Yes, Judge
Johnson. Following up on Judge Schleter's question about what do we do with your second argument if we were to affirm on the first, would you agree that in that event, we would need to consider whether the decision being challenged in part two would have a critical impact on the trial independently? And if so, how would you satisfy that test?
Yes, I would agree that the court would need to consider independently whether that issue has critical impact. I believe that the court, and that I think critical impact is satisfied and because essentially what defense counsel did by taking this statement is created a Dexter issue that prompted all of this litigation in the first place. There was no substantial indication of a firm intent to recant until defense counsel elicited this first statement, the recorded statement, without someone else present. And that has resulted in this entire litigation in the district court.
But isn't the question for us, whether going forward it would be a different trial or whether the state's case would be critically impacted if defendant's trial counsel continued to represent him throughout the trial or a different lawyer did? I mean, that's the question, right, going forward?
It is. I guess the best way I can look at this, and I don't know if the court will agree, but the best way I can look at this and try to help the court understand the problem that has been created is that Dexter prohibits the state from calling the witness for the sole purpose of impeaching the witness, the recanting witness. But what it doesn't do is prohibit the state from calling the witness to testify and to ask the witness what happened on the night in question. And the state could still do that. The state might not, I quite frankly think that there's a reasonable question here about what this this individual would do when called to testify under oath. And in the event that the state does that, what we don't have is what the defendant doesn't have is the ability to inquire into the circumstances surrounding that statement that defense counsel took if the victim were to deny making that statement to defense counsel. The truth-seeking process here, and this goes back to the residual exception, which we didn't really talk about, the truth-seeking process is being frustrated here. And credibility determinations that are for the jury are being taken away from the jury.
Didn't the defendant stipulate to the admissibility of the statements?
The defendant offered to stipulate, but that offer to stipulate is not reasonable, because if the defendant is the one who seeks to use it, they can't stipulate to the admissibility of it. And I touched on this in the reply brief, Rule 902 and its comment that suggests that other solutions should be sought rather than disqualification doesn't apply to this case, because this isn't the defendant's witness. This is the victim of a crime. And it is highly, highly inappropriate and irregular for defense counsel to take this kind of statement. And I cited the ABA standard for defense counsel. This is exactly the kind of witness who defense counsel should know full well they need to have a third party witness present for. And that action by defense counsel has so tainted this litigation that it's created a morass for everyone to try and find their way through. And that's ultimately why we're here. I see my time has expired.
You've answered Judge Johnson's extended question. Mr. Neivel, we don't generally allow for any sir rebuttal. We did allow Mr. Smith to go quite a bit over and address an issue. If you can very briefly, as in within 15 seconds, say what is clearly itching you onward, I'll allow it.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. First, Mr. Smith did not accurately represent what I said in my brief. At page 14, I indicate, I didn't say you cannot possibly be under the aura of excitement if you're intoxicated. My statement is, being intoxicated makes it implausible that you could still be under the aura. Number two, and I'm not going to try to address everything he said about the...
Well, you can't, because I think... Your brief is well presented, and we're certainly not going to assume that any argument is waived, and we'll consider your briefs. But you know, usually on the other side of these things, Mr. Neivel, we don't let the state go on and serve rebuttal. So I think we should end this. But I thought you were going to cite to some supplemental authority, which I was going to allow, even though we usually provide the option only in writing.
I just wanted to point out that defense counsel lists in her witness list, document ID number 69, everyone named in the complaint, okay, which includes the alleged victim. So she can call him. She did list him.
Thank you, Mr. Neivel. We probably afforded more liberties than my colleagues on the court would tolerate. Of course, this is a publicly recorded, so any abuse I'll have to take from my colleagues for letting you both go on a bit over.
I apologize.
No, you don't have to apologize. It's helpful to us to hear the argument, and frankly, we've got these rules and we hold to them pretty strictly, but you know, we don't have to all the time. So I do appreciate your argument, both of you, in your briefing and your oral argument. And we will consider the matter submitted at this time, take it under advisement, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Now, both of you have a very nice day.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
That's our last oral argument today, and so the court is now in recess.